As 20 of the royal guard set off in hot pursuit of Darius and Cecilia, Julia ran with them, sword in hand. Budine was dead because of Darius and his schemes, and Julia had promised herself a vengeance. Together, side by side, King John and Prince Harold walked slowly forward to confront the three Landsgraves, the only men in the hall still holding swords. Half the royal guard moved protectively after the king.
Hello, John. All in all, it's been an interesting day, hasn't it?
Did you really think my son would betray me, Blaze?
It seemed a reasonable possibility.
We've known each other more years than I care to remember, Blaze. Time was when you were one of my staunchest allies, as close to me as my own family. And now this? Why, Blaze? Why did you turn against me?
The katana. When you decided to draw that cursed sword, you became a threat to my master. You must have known I couldn't stand by and do nothing.
So you took the katana for fear I'd use it against the barons. That was never my intention, Blaze. Now more than ever, I need the katana to throw back the darkness. Return the sword to me, and I promise you'll face nothing more than exile.
What kind of deal is that, John? You know we don't have the sword. Or are you just looking for an excuse to order our execution?
I order you to hand over the sword of compulsion, Blaze.
I don't have it.
You stole it from my armory, traitor!
Liar!
Blaze raised his sword, but a guardsman intervened. Sir Blaze looked down to find a sword rammed into his gut. The guardsman who ran him through looked at the Landsgrave with a mix of contempt and pity.
You have betrayed our king, noble Landsgrave. That was your last mistake.
Sir Bedivere charged forward. He began cutting down guardsmen as if he were harvesting grain.
Father, step back. Face me, Bedivere.
Harold ducked under the swinging sword and lunged forward. Despite the jagged wound in his side, Bedivere showed no signs of slowing down. As Harold lay stunned on the floor, the Landsgrave continued his dogged pursuit of the king, who was shielded by more guardsmen. King John stood grimly waiting, sword in hand. The sword was a comforting weight, but he knew it wasn't going to be enough to stop Bedivere.
Sire, you should withdraw!
No, I will not run. I will not be seen cowering from a common traitor.
Very well.
The guardsman who had protected the king for years stepped forward, awaiting the berserker's approach. The guard fell to the floor, and Bedivere moved in to sever his head. But the guard rolled away, and the Landsgrave's sword stuck deep into the floor. Bedivere needed both hands to pull it out. Bedivere had just barely pulled his weapon from the wood. Sparks flew as swords locked. The guard had the advantage of leverage, and they both knew it. Blood from the Landsgrave's wound had run all the way down to his boots, leaving a slick on the floor. The guard leaned in harder, bringing Bedivere to his knees. Bedivere suddenly rolled to one side, leaving the guard unbalanced. And in that split second, the berserker pulled a small knife from a hidden pocket and launched it at the guardsman. The knife buried itself to the hilt in the guard's gut. He looked down at his wound and saw blood spilling out in short bursts. And in that moment, the Landsgrave struck.
No!
Bedivere turned, his face covered in other men's blood. What little humanity the man had was lost in primal rage. He faced the king with murder on his mind. For a moment, the two men stared at each other, no more than a few yards between them. Bedivere's chainmail hung in bloody tatters, but his sword was still steady in his hand, and his eyes were filled with a constant crimson glare. King John could see more of his guards moving forward to attack the Landsgrave, but he knew they'd never reach Bedivere in time. The man was going to kill him. Bedivere drew back his sword, and King John braced himself for the blow he'd never feel. Harold stepped in and hamstrung Sir Bedivere from behind. He fell heavily to the floor, his severed leg muscles no longer capable of supporting him. King John watched grimly as the surviving guardsman reached him. Sir Bedivere died frothing at the mouth and trying to bite the hands that wielded swords against him.
Sorry, Father, but it had to be done. He would have killed you.
King John nodded curtly and turned to Sir Gwillem. The sole surviving Landsgrave stared desperately about him, his sword trembling in his hand. John wondered briefly why the man hadn't made a run for it, and then realized that both Blaze and Bedivere had fought and been killed in less than a minute.
Guards, take Sir Gwillem away. There's been enough killing for one day.
The two guardsmen moved confidently forward, underestimating the Landsgrave. For a moment, nobody moved. The Landsgrave had moved so quickly, his attack had been little more than a blur. And then he moved again, and men died where they stood. He moved among the guards with murderous ease, deflecting every blow aimed against him with movements almost too fast to be seen. Blood flew in the air, and King John watched his best men fall to a man who had introduced himself as an accountant.
Dear God, the man's a blade master. I wonder why the barons made him a Landsgrave. What better assassin could there be than a man who's unbeatable with a sword in his hand? I should have guessed, but they're so rare these days, so very rare.
Father, you'd better get out of here. Those guards aren't going to hold Gwillem long. He's more of a danger than Bedivere ever was.
I think you may well be right, but I'm not running until I must. Sir Gwillem may be unbeatable with a sword, but let's see how he fares against a couple of crossbows. Guards!
He gestured to two waiting guardsmen who stepped quickly forward.
No!
Fire!
Sir Gwillem was slammed violently against the wall. He hung still and silent from the two heavy steel bolts pinning him to the wall.
We're going to die, Darius. They know we're traitors, and they're going to kill us.
Shut up, woman. We're not caught yet. Nobody knows about my hidden entrance here. Come on, come on. Open, damn you.
You!
Julia burst in, just in time to see the huge bookcase swinging slowly open, revealing a concealed passage. Darius stood beside the bookcase, waiting impatiently for it to open wide enough for him to enter. Cecilia was clinging frantically to his arm. Gregory turned to face Julia, sword in hand. She hesitated in the doorway, sweeping her sword back and forth before her. She'd easily outdistanced the guards, weighed down by their heavy armor, and Julia quickly realized that they weren't going to catch up in time to help her. She smiled grimly. At best, the odds were only 2-1 against her. Gregory hefted his sword and glanced back at Darius.
Get Cecilia out of here. I'll hold them off.
Darius tried to force his bulk into the slowly widening gap between the wall and the bookcase. Cecilia pressed close beside him, clinging tightly to his arm as though for comfort.
Would you get away, woman?
No! Don't leave me! Please, Darius!
Get away from me! Now!
Darius pushed her away, but she only tightened her grip, wedging them both into the narrow gap. The first of the guards burst into the room, followed quickly by a dozen more. Gregory moved forward to block their way. His sword trembled in his hand, but in his eyes, Julia could see a determination to sell his life dearly. He grinned mockingly at the guards and then glanced back at the bookcase, just in time to see Darius draw a dagger from his sleeve.
I have warned you, Cecilia. Now get away!
Cecilia! No!
Gregory dropped his sword and rushed to Cecilia.
Cecilia, my love, what has he done to you?
The bookcase is closing! Quick, after him!
Darius disappeared into the concealed passageway. By the time the guardsmen got to it, the gap was once again too narrow to let them pass, but they couldn't stop the bookcase from closing. Julia approached Gregory cautiously, her sword held out before her, but he just sat on the floor, cradling Cecilia's body in his arms. Her eyes stared wildly, and blood seeped steadily from her tattered bodice, staining Gregory's tunic where he held her to him.
No, there wasn't any need for this. No need. Cecilia!
Come on, Gregory. Leave her. There's nothing you can do for her now.
Cecilia!
She's dead, Gregory.
The small fire was warm and comforting, but Julia was too tired even to hold out her hands to the leaping flames. Exhaustion had crept up on her in the short time it had taken to walk from Darius's hall to the king's private chambers. And now a harsh, persistent pain beat dully in her back and legs. And it was all she could do to keep her eyes from closing against her will. Julia tried to sit up straighter in her battered, overstuffed chair and knuckled her bleary eyes. It would be only too easy just to lie back and doze off in the gentle warmth of the fire. But she couldn't let herself rest. It had been a long, hard day, and it didn't seem to be finished with her yet. Harold smiled tiredly at her from the chair opposite. Unlike Julia, he slumped bonelessly in his chair, his long legs stretched out, his feet resting on a footstool, his toes quietly toasting before the fire. Fatigue had shaded heavy bags under his eyes, giving him a dissipated, brooding look. His crooked smile suggested that he'd like to be pleased with himself, but was too tired to make the effort. A cup of hot mulled cider stood on a small table beside his chair, slowly cooling. King John sat between the two of them in an old high-backed chair, pulling thoughtfully at his beard and frowning into the fire. He still wore his thick fur coat, wrapped around his shoulders like a grandmother's shawl, and every now and again he shivered, as though in response to a cold wind only he could feel. Julia watched him worriedly. Tired, though he obviously was, he should have been elated, or at the very least pleased. He had broken the rebellion before it even got started, killed most of the ringleaders, and avoided a civil war that would have destroyed the Forest Kingdom. But instead, his mouth was grim, and his gaze was troubled, and in some subtle way, he looked older. Julia looked away. The king's private chambers were much smaller than she'd expected. Her father lived in rooms large enough to drill troops in, where fabulous tapestries hung from every marble wall, gorgeous mosaics covered the floors, and huge glass windows filled every room with a blaze of light. Of course, the Duke's palace was drafty as hell and impossible to heat, but the Duke didn't care. He had a position to maintain and appearances to keep up. And on bad days, the Duke seemed to believe that if he so much as entered a room less than 50 feet square, he was slumming. Julia smiled tightly. There were things about Hillsdown she missed, but her father's palace definitely wasn't one of them. Neither was her father, come to that. King John's rooms were altogether different. Not one of them was more than 15 feet square, and they all seemed to have been furnished with comfort rather than fashion in mind. Julia looked approvingly about her at the combined sitting room and bedchamber, and smiled indulgently. The room had that comfortable, cramped coziness that only men living alone can achieve. Books lined the walls from floor to ceiling and overflowed onto the tables and chairs where they fought for space with plates and cups and papers of state. Chipped statuettes and faded miniatures filled every nook and cranny, jostling each other for position. Much of the room's furniture was worn and battered and had the look of something retained long past the time when its usefulness was over, simply because it was old and familiar. Even the many rugs that covered the floor from wall to wall were threadbare in patches.
Can't get used to being in my winter quarters this early. Feels all wrong. Here it is autumn, and already there are snowdrifts a foot deep and ice covering the moat. The leaves have barely left the trees, and yet without a roaring fire close at hand day and night, my old bones ache with cold. And the damn servants have set up my furniture all wrong. They did it on purpose, just because I shouted at them a few times.
We did make our migration a little early this year. You have to make allowances.
No, I don't. I'm the king. No, you're right. I shouldn't have shouted at them. But when you get to be my age, the little things in life become more important than they should. In my rooms, there's a place for everything. Everything in its place. Oh, you can smile, Julia, but all you see is clutter. Well, maybe it is a mess at that, but it's a mess of my making, and I'm used to it. If I wake in the night and it's dark, I know I can just reach out my hand and find the candle in its usual place. Not that it ever is dark now. I have to be sure that the damn fire is properly banked before I go to bed, or risk spending half the night shivering under the covers. Can't stand that fire. It sits there while I'm trying to sleep, making me jump with sudden noises, and all the time glaring at me like a great red eye.
King John turned to see who had entered, and saw Lord Vivian striding calmly into the room with a guardsman's blade at his back. He stopped a fair distance away from the king and stood quietly at ease, ignoring everyone. His scabbard was empty, but his hands were unbound.
Thank you, guard. You may leave us. Hello, Vivian.
You trust me enough to leave me unguarded in your presence?
Of course. You're unarmed.
Now, you're here because I want to talk to you. The Landsgraves are dead and Darius is still missing, which makes you the nearest thing to a leader the rebels have. They'll listen to you where they might not believe me. So, what I'm about to say to you is intended for their ears as well. Is that clear?
Of course. But then I'm hardly in a position to disagree, am I? My life is in your hands.
You're to be exiled, not executed.
We're dead either way. Traditionally, exiles are allowed neither weapons nor shelter till they're beyond the forest boundaries. Once outside the protection of the castle walls, my fellow traitors and I will be sitting targets for the first demons to come along.
You could always beg protection from the barons.
Hardly. The barons don't have enough food to feed their own people, never mind 300 more mouths. And without their providing an armed escort, it's extremely unlikely any of us would survive the journey through the forest. I've led scouting parties from one end of this kingdom to the other. The demons are everywhere. Put us outside these walls unarmed, and you're condemning us to death.
There is an alternative to exile.
I thought there might be.
Earlier this evening, I granted an audience to a deputation from the outlying farms. They're overrun with demons and fighting a losing battle against the plague. They came to me for help, and I had to tell them there was nothing I could do. But now it seems to me that, just possibly, there is some help I can offer after all. Go with them, Lord Vivian. You and all your fellow rebels. Escort the deputation back to their farms, defend them against the demons, and teach the farmers how to defend themselves. I'll supply you with weapons, horses, and whatever provisions we can spare. It's not much of a choice I'm offering you. If the demons don't get you, the plague probably will. But all of those who serve me in this matter will receive a full pardon. And when the Dark has finally been defeated, those of you who survive may return to the Forest Castle with a clean slate.
You're right. It isn't much of a choice. I accept your offer on behalf of myself and my fellow traitors.
That's very good to hear. I won't deceive you, Lord Vivian. The odds are that none of you will survive to claim that pardon.
It's a fighting chance, sire. And that's all I've ever asked for.
Lord Vivian stood straight and tall before the king, his head held high. And for the first time since he entered the king's chambers, there was something about him that might have been dignity and pride. Julia studied him warily, impressed in spite of herself. It occurred to her that just because a man is a traitor, it doesn't automatically follow that he's a villain or a coward.
My seneschal will take you to the farmers. Their leader is a man called Maddock Thorne. Obey his orders as you would mine. Give him all the support you can, Lord Vivian. They were true to me even after I failed them.
We will defend their lives with our own, sire. My word on it.
Why did you betray me, Vivian?
Ambition, sire. I wished to be High Commander of the Guard.
No other reason?
No, sire. No other reason worth the mentioning.
Harold shot Vivian a quick glance, but said nothing.
Well then, I'll see you again, my lord, when all this is over.
Of course, sire.
He bowed formally to the king, and then turned and left, ignoring Harold and Julia.
Do you really think he's going to stay with the farmers?
Of course. He gave his word.
And you trust it?
He's a strange chap, Vivian. I've known him half my life, and I still don't understand what goes on behind those cold, empty eyes of his. He firmly believes in looking out for his own best interests, and yet, in his own strange way, he's intensely loyal to the land. He follows no cause save his own, but he's never been known to break his word. He wants to be reinstated, and he wants to do penance. I've just given him the chance to do both. He'll hate taking orders from peasants, but he'll do it. And cut down any of his fellows who refuse. A strange chap, Vivian, but always loyal to the land and its needs.
Don't worry, Julia. Vivian's a cold bastard, but he knows his duty. He won't betray us again.
Well, that's two problems solved anyway. Unfortunately, we're no nearer finding the Cortana.
The Cortana? I thought the Landsgraves had it.
Apparently not. I've got my guards searching the traitor's quarters, but I don't think they're going to find anything. Blaze swore to the end that he hadn't taken it, and I'm beginning to believe him.
Gwilym or Bedivere could have taken it.
Not without Blaze knowing.
I'm inclined to agree. And that means that somewhere in this castle there's a traitor we haven't found yet.
Damn right. The same traitor who let demons into the South Wing.
No, I'd forgotten about that.
I haven't. I've still got the scars to remind me.
Time to worry about that tomorrow. All in all, it's been a fairly successful day, I suppose. Considering how easily it might have all gone horribly wrong.
True. If you hadn't brought those crossbowmen with you, there's no telling how many Sir Gwilym would have killed.
Quite. I was lucky there. The Landsgraves openly threatened me earlier this evening when I was meeting with the farmer's deputation, only to back down and leave when the farmer supported me. That intrigued me. What on earth did the farmers have that could rout the Landsgraves so easily? The answer was simple. My guards had swords, but the farmers had longbows. So I played a hunch and it worked out, but 348 traitors. 348! Not as many as I feared, but a damn sight more than there should have been.
Don't blame yourself. They're the ones who failed the land, not you. Besides, I talked to most of them at the party. Believe me, you're better off without them.
Harold, how could you play along with such people? Living a double life, different lives for different people, how could you stand it? Why didn't you just turn Darius in when he first approached you?
He did. I persuaded him to carry on with the deception, but keep me informed. The party was Harold's idea, and thanks to him, we caught all the rats in one fell swoop. Now I know who I can trust and who is false, and I know my son is loyal.
Was there ever any doubt?
No, but it was nice to be proved right.
What's going to happen with the Barons now? More plots? More conspiracies?
They won't be any trouble. They wanted to find out which of us was the stronger, and now they know. They'll just disown their Landsgraves, publicly condemn the rebels, and promise me anything as long as I don't withdraw my troops and leave them to face the demons on their own. No, Julia, they won't risk rocking the boat again.
Then it's all over. The rebellion is dead.
Not quite. There's still no sign of Lord Darius. We did finally force that damn bookcase open, but all we found was a tunnel leading into the air vents, and they go on for miles. I'd no idea so many of the interior walls were hollow.
But that means he could be anywhere.
He's just another rat in the walls. We'll get him, Julia, never fear. The guards are searching the tunnels for him even now. We'll have him by morning.
How's Gregory?
Who?
Cecilia's lover.
Oh, him. Hanged himself in his cell, poor bastard.
I never liked him, but somehow I felt sorry for him. He wasn't a bad sort in the end. He deserved better than Darius and Cecilia.
I have no doubt he would have killed any one of us if the Barons had ordered it. He was just in the wrong place at the wrong time.
And he loved the wrong woman.
Yes, I suppose he did.
I'm tired. Unless you want me for anything else, I'm going back to my chambers to get some sleep.
I'll walk part of the way with you.
All right. I think I'd like some company.
Get yourself some rest, my children. You've earned it. It's been a long, hard day for all of us.
They were almost at the door when the king suddenly stirred in his chair.
Julia, Badim was a friend of yours, wasn't he?
No. I didn't really know him at all.
Darkness lay across the forest land from boundary to boundary, complete and unbroken, save for an uncertain pool of light surrounding the forest castle. Demons moved silently through the smothering dark, sharpening their claws on the decaying bark of dying trees. No sun shone, and though a moon sailed endlessly on the night skies, its light was foul and unhealthy. Plants died for lack of sunlight, and wildlife either starved or fell prey to the demons' never-ending hunger. Snow and ice covered all the ground, and the freezing air drew the warmth from everything it touched. Men barricaded themselves and their families inside whatever shelter they could find, and prayed for a dawn that never came. Cold and dark and utterly merciless, the long night held dominion over all. blinding silver light poured out into the darkness as space itself ripped open. Demons shuddered and fled from the sound, but the unrelenting sound came from everywhere and nowhere, and there was no escaping it. Prince Rupert and his party had finally come home. Rupert stared dazedly about him as he took in the sight. He was sure he'd spent no more than a few seconds in the tunnel, but in that brief moment the world had moved on and everything was changed. A familiar stench of decay and corruption filled his nostrils, and the horrid, numbing oppression fell upon him like an old familiar cloak. He gripped the unicorn's reins tightly as he stared wildly around, convinced the warlock had bungled the spell and dropped them back in the dark wood they'd just passed through. But Rupert's eyes went automatically to the only remaining light, the dim, wavering glow surrounding Forest Castle.
No!
For a moment, Rupert hurt so badly he couldn't breathe, and he shook his head in wordless denial. He'd made it to the Dark Tower in time. There was no way in which the long night could have reached this far into the forest. But there before him stood the castle, shimmering whitely under a thick blanket of snow and ice and hoarfrost. Long, jagged icicles hung from every window and turret, and the moat seemed no more than a single great slab of ice. Torches flickered at regular intervals along the battlements, but their dirty yellow glow did little to throw back the encroaching night. Rupert shuddered uncontrollably, but it had little to do with the bitter cold that was already seeping into his bones. It was one thing to fight his way through the dark wood as part of a quest, or because it stood between him and the High Warlock. But it had no right to be here, threatening his home. The Darkwood had always been something that happened somewhere else, somewhere comfortably far away. Until now, he'd never believed that the castle that had served the Forest Kings for 13 generations could ever fall to the darkness. It was impossible. It couldn't be happening. Rupert fought hard against his rising hysteria and slowly brought himself back under control. His mind turned frantically this way and that, searching for an answer, any answer, as to what had gone wrong. How could the Darkwood have spread so fast? And then, finally, Rupert looked up. Directly above him, floating on a starless night that went on forever, hung the full moon. Its color was that of tainted cheese or leprous flesh, the only color the eye can see at dead of night. The blue moon had risen. Time moves differently in the dark wood. Rupert turned slowly to stare at the High Warlock.
What have you done? Damn you, what have you done?
I don't know. Something must have interfered with my teleport spell. This is the right place, but the wrong time. I can't understand it.
We can discuss this later, sire. Unsheathe your swords and light your lanterns, men. There are demons all around us. Our arrival seems to have startled them almost as much as it did us, but they won't stay startled much longer. We do well to get out of here while we still can.
Rupert glanced briefly at his guardsmen, already set up in a tight defensive circle, their swords out and their lanterns lit. Their quiet competence steadied him, and he ruthlessly suppressed the vestiges of fear and panic that still moved deep within him.
You're right, Sir Champion. Let's get the men moving. You and I will take the lead. The High Warlock will guard the rear with his magic. You can do that much, can't you, Sir Warlock?
Why, I... Yes, I can do that.
Good. Stay close together, watch your backs, and once we've started, don't stop for anything. It can't be more than 500 yards to the castle. And after all we've been through, it's going to take more than a few demons to stop us going home. All right, let's go. Last man in pays for the beer.
It wasn't much of a pep talk, and Rupert knew it, but the guards humored him anyway. Rupert grinned savagely back, fiercely proud of all of them, and then turned away so they wouldn't see the tears that stung his eyes. He took a firm hold of the unicorn's reins and started forward.
Shouldn't we be running?
No. If the demons sense we're afraid, they'll attack. A show of confidence like this might just hold them off while we get a little closer to the castle.
Oh, any little bit helps, right?
Right.
Rupert glanced surreptitiously about him. The champion strode at his side, hefting his massive war axe as though it were weightless. The guards and the warlock padded along quietly behind them in a tight bunch, alert and ready for any sudden sound or movement in the surrounding dark.
Rupert couldn't hear the demons that moved along with the party, but every now and again there was a sudden gleam of watching blood-red eyes, glaring in the dark like angry coals, or a fleeting glimpse of silent, misshapen figures as they darted from shadow to shadow before and behind the party. Rupert scowled and tried to shrug his cloak more comfortably around him. The bitter cold grated painfully in his bones, and he couldn't seem to stop shivering. It had been a long time since he'd known anything but the snow and sleet and freezing air of the winter come early. He was beginning to forget what it was like to feel warm. A sudden movement caught the corner of his eye, and he glared helplessly into the darkness. The castle was drawing steadily nearer, but its light didn't penetrate far into the dark wood. Rupert smiled grimly. He didn't need to see the demons to know they were there, and it didn't matter a damn how many more there were. If it came to a fight, the odds were that none of his party would survive to reach the castle. Their only hope was to get as close to the castle as possible, and then make a run for it. It wasn't much of a hope. Rupert gripped his sword hilt until his fingers ached, but his hands still shook. The unremitting weight of the dark wood beat down on him with all its old familiar horror, and it was no easier to bear now than it had been before. Every time his duty forced him back into the darkness, he hoped against hope it would be easier to deal with. But it never was. Every time it was worse. Fear and panic and mind-numbing despair sank into him like icy water in his soul. Until all he wanted was to lie down, curl into a ball, and scream for it to go away. But he couldn't do that. He wouldn't do that. He hadn't brought his men this far just to give up on them when they were nearly home. Rupert stared at the castle before him, drawing nearer with every step. Nearly there. Nearly home. So bloody near. The unicorn lurched tiredly beside him, and Rupert reached up and patted the animal's neck comfortingly.
Whew, not much longer now. One last stretch of the legs, and then we can all take a rest.
Yeah, well, you keep telling me that. A nice long rest in a warm, dry stable. And I'm gonna believe it when I see it, not before. I just hope they got some decent food. I've had nothing but grass for weeks. I think I'd kill for some barley.
When we're safely in the castle, I'll bury you in barley.
Look, given our present situation, I don't think that remark's in the best of taste.
Rupert and the unicorn shared a look.
It's been a strange journey, all told.
I wouldn't argue with that.
You know, we're probably not going to make it.
The thought had crossed my mind.
I just want to say thanks for being with me when I needed you.
Oh, I wouldn't have missed it for anything. You know, you're not a bad sort, Rupert. I mean, for a human.
Well, thanks. I think. Friends again?
Sure. Why not?
Great.
I still want that barley you promised me.
What are you two going on about?
Nothing. It won't matter much soon.
Rupert hefted his sword and was pleased to discover that his hand was now a little steadier. In a way, he almost wished the demons would attack and get it over with. When he was fighting, there wasn't time to be scared. He breathed deeply to calm himself, and then regretted it as the dark wood's constant stench of decay was suddenly strong in his nostrils again. Rupert shook his head grimly and glanced back over his shoulder. The guards were still moving silently along behind him, swords at the ready. But Rupert's heart missed a beat when he realized the High Warlock was no longer with them. For a moment, panic froze him in place, and then he relaxed as he looked up and saw that the Warlock had taken to the air, floating silently and serenely a good 10 feet above the ground. The Warlock's eyes were closed, and a deep scowl furrowed his brow, as though he was concentrating on some problem not immediately apparent. His hands seemed to be glowing slightly, and for the first time, Rupert realized that his party was moving in its own narrow pool of light. Rupert looked away. At least the Warlock's magic was good for something. The castle drew steadily nearer, shimmering palely like a giant stone ghost in its own torchlight. There were no guards on the battlements, but the drawbridge was up. Rupert smiled dourly. If the demons ever decided to overrun the castle, they wouldn't bother using the drawbridge. They'd just swarm right over the walls. He remembered the last time he'd ridden into the castle courtyard, only to find it silent and deserted. He shook his head angrily. He couldn't have come this far, only to find he'd returned home too late. He just couldn't. Where the hell are the demons? What are they waiting for? The castle was 300 yards away. 200. 100. And then the demons came for them. Rupert barely had time to raise his sword before the demons were all around him. And then there was only a confused melee of steel and blood and reaching clawed hands. He swung his sword in short, vicious arcs, cutting through demon flesh with controlled, economical strokes, and the fresh stink of demon blood was heavy on the air. They came from every direction, twisted, malformed creatures with fangs and claws and eyes that do nothing but an endless, never-sated hunger. The earth trembled under Rupert's feet and then cracked open. Hundreds of pale, slimy tentacles whipped up out of the broken earth and reached for the struggling guardsmen with a horrid single-mindedness of purpose. Rupert glared down into one of the wider cracks as he cut through a writhing tentacle. The crack was filled with hundreds of needle-fanged mouths and a single great staring eye. Rupert shrank back, and the eye moved slightly to follow him. Something with wings and black-furred spider legs swooped down to a beleaguered guard. It tore out his throat and disappeared back into the dark before the body hit the ground. Exhausted almost beyond the point of pain, Rupert put his back to one of the gnarled dying trees and swung his sword mechanically back and forth before him. And still the demons came, some on two legs, some on four, and some slithering on their bellies in the dirt. In the unsteady light, it seemed to Rupert that many of the nightmare shapes shifted and ran like watery clay, even as they pressed silently forward to attack the besieged party. Strange, unhealthy hybrids of plant and animal and insect rose and fell before him, loathsome creatures that could never have survived in the natural world. Rupert fought on. There were always more to replace those who died under his blade. A heavy weight fell on him from above, and something cold and scaly clung tightly to his shoulders while its slender, clawed hands groped eagerly for his eyes and throat. He struggled with the thing, but its claws just sunk deeper in his back. The grinning, elongated head swung forward, right for his shoulder. His arm immediately went limp. The demons before him salivated, preparing to strike. One leapt straight for him, its teeth shining in the moonlight. A blast of searing white light ripped through the group, leaving behind nothing but a few charred, distorted bones.
Back! Back, you demon spawn!
Rupert clawed at the demon on his back until a blast of balefire tore the creature from him. Only the head remained, clinging grimly to his shoulder, even in death. All around him, the demons were falling back into the surrounding shadows, unable to face the High Warlock's balefire. The blood-smeared tentacles withdrew into the earth and were gone, and within seconds, the Darkwood was once again utterly still and silent.
Thanks for the help. I thought we were done for.
Rupert, can you hear me?
The Warlock nodded once and waved his hand toward the remaining flames.
Yeah, but my left arm's numb, and I can't get this bloody head off my shoulder.
Here, let me see if I can pry it off with my dagger. There we go.
Oh, thanks.
Let me help you up.
Lean on me, Rupert. Get your strength back.
I think I will.
Oh. How bad is it?
The pain's not going away, which is good, I think. It's not unbearable. I can feel the blood running down my arm, but I can't feel my hand at all.
Uh-oh, that's not good.
I'll worry about that later. I'll worry about a lot of things later. Sir Champion?
Sire?
We've got to get to the castle, Sir Champion. There's nothing left but running now. If we stand and fight, we're all dead. Get the men together and tell them we're moving now. The High Warlock can cover our backs. Am I making sense?
Yes.
Good. You lead the way, Sir Champion. We'll follow.
Yes, sire. We'd make better time if you were to ride the unicorn.
Rupert looked at the unicorn. Even in his dazed state, he could clearly see the blood that dappled the animal's heaving sides. The unicorn had looked like this once before, the time he'd nearly died in the Darkwood clearing. Rupert thrust the memory away.
How about it, unicorn? Can you carry me that far?
Ah, sure. I'm barely scratched. Climb aboard, Rupert.
Rupert swayed a moment in the saddle and fought hard not to pass out. He glanced down at his right hand and smiled grimly. Somehow, he was still hanging onto his sword. A good omen, if you believed in omens.
You hear that?
Oh, I heard that.
They're coming again. Run for the castle now!
His guards were off and running almost before he'd finished speaking. He clung desperately to the unicorn's sides with his knees as the animal started forward and stared grimly about him. The champion ran before him, his war axe at the ready. The high warlock flew overhead, balefire enveloping his hands. And 14 guardsmen followed Rupert home. 14. 14 out of 50. Rupert leaned wearily forward against the unicorn's neck as the last of his strength flowed out of him. His hold on his sword slowly loosened, and only the awful pain that shuddered through him with every jolt of the uneven trail kept him awake. He didn't mind falling, he was used to that. But his men had followed him and trusted him, and all he'd done was lead them to their deaths. Just as he'd once led the unicorn to his death, lying broken and bloodied in the small clearing in the Darkwood. Only this time, there wasn't a rainbow to drive back the dark. His eyes kept dropping shut, even with the pain in his shoulder. Rupert knew he was probably going into shock, but didn't care. The shock seemed to be numbing both his pain and his memories, and he'd settle for that. The giant trees of the forest loomed in and out of the darkness as the unicorn carried him steadily towards the castle, and Rupert swallowed sickly when he saw the vast patches of open decay that mottled their bark. For all the darkness and the swarming demons, he hadn't been able to accept that the forest was dead. The very idea was unthinkable. The forest had existed for endless centuries before man, and deep down, Rupert had always believed that it would still be there centuries after man had vanished and been forgotten. To see the great and ancient trees already dead and rotting hurt Rupert even more than his own likely imminent death. For if the forest itself could fall to the darkness, what chance was there for anything or anybody? The last of Rupert's hope died in that moment, and slowly, the world began to fade away around him, taking the pain and the heartbreak with it. He spotted a demon coming toward him. He cut the demon in half, drenching the unicorn in its blood. Rupert stared blankly at his bloody sword, and then shook his head fiercely as a slow, steady anger burned through him, shocking him awake again. He might be too late to save the forest, but perhaps he could still avenge it.
We're surrounded!
But we can still fight!
The champion cut his way through the demons, leaving an open path for the rest. The guardsmen ranged themselves to either side of the unicorn and fought furiously to hold off the solid, heaving mass of demon kind that had erupted silently out of the surrounding dark. Rupert watched helplessly as more of his men died horribly under the flailing claws and fangs of the demons. He had to concentrate on hanging onto the unicorn as best he could. He tried to grasp the reins with his left hand, but his fingers wouldn't obey him. The castle was only 50 yards away, but it might as well have been 50 miles. The way ahead was completely blocked by the demons. Rupert knew another of his men had fallen under the demon swarm. He felt a sudden, almost overpowering urge to turn the unicorn round and ride back into the darkness, to kill and kill until he and his blade were drenched in demon blood, to die fighting rather than running. The impulse passed as swiftly as it came, but the rage would remain. He raised his sword high and beckoned the unicorn to move to the front. He hadn't come this far just to throw his life away on a gesture. He'd fought his way through the dark wood to summon the High Warlock from his dark tower, and now he was going home, and to hell with anyone or anything that got in his way. The unicorn struggled on, step by step. Rupert's sword arm rose and fell in steady butchery. The castle grew gradually closer, and still the demons came. 40 yards. 30. 25.
What was that?
Doesn't matter! Keep going!
It wasn't until the ground itself began to shake in time to the deep bass rhythm that he realized he was listening to the sound of something indescribably huge and heavy moving slowly through the dark wood after him. Rupert risked a quick glance back over his shoulder, but the impenetrable darkness turned aside his gaze with contemptuous ease. The ground shook violently as the creature drew nearer, and Rupert realized that something different was coming out of the darkness, something huge and old and unspeakably powerful. He remembered the great white mass he'd fought in the Coppertown pit.
Go, go, go! There are too many demons, there's nowhere to go!
Sure enough, creatures were still swarming out of the darkness. The clearing that the champion had made had turned into a small patch, and the remaining guards were just barely holding. It was like trying to hold back the ocean.
Warlock! We could use your help about now!
I'm working on it!
The warlock's entire body looked to be shimmering with a faint light, but it didn't seem to have any effect on the monsters. The champion's axe had long ago turned a deep crimson, and some of the blood on him looked to be his own. Rupert risked a glance around him and noticed one more man had fallen. He hadn't even heard him scream. Then light blazed suddenly in the long night, throwing back the dark as the High Warlock finally unleashed his power. Trees were uprooted and thrown aside, and demons disintegrated as a vast invisible force slammed them to the ground and crushed the life from them. The earth rose and fell like a great slow wave as the warlock's magic moved across it, and Rupert shuddered as he felt the warlock's power pulsing in the fetid air, coursing through the darkness, wild and unstoppable. There was something primal and savage in the magic the High Warlock had set loose in the world, something held at bay only by the warlock's will. It seethed and flashed on the air, destroying everything outside of Rupert's party, and yet somehow, deep in his soul, Rupert knew that it was only the High Warlock who kept this awful power from flying free to attack the castle and the forest and all that was in one vast orgy of destruction. The demons fled back into the darkness. And the power followed them.
Thanks.
Don't mention it.
Let's go.
The warlock flew after them, slowly twisting and turning in midair as though in response to a wind only he could feel. Rupert swayed in the saddle as the castle keep loomed up before him, and he knew the last of his strength was finally running out. He clenched his fingers round his sword hilt, desperate not to drop it. The champion looked behind him to where the High Warlock's magic didn't reach.
Looks like there's still more demons out there.
We haven't got far to go. I just hope they decide to hold off until we make it.
The guards already see us. They'll help us.
Unless there's too many demons following us. They wouldn't dare risk the castle being overrun.
They'll open for us.
How do you know?
Rupert's eyes seemed to be getting heavier by the second. He thought about how nice it would be to sit in front of a nice, warm fire, eating a bowl of hot soup. Maybe then he'd curl up in bed and sleep for a week or two. It was his daydreaming that kept him from noticing the creature waiting on a tree above him. Something squat and hairy had dropped on the unicorn's neck. It clung tenaciously, its weight almost forcing the unicorn to a halt. Thin runnels of blood trickled down the unicorn's neck as the demon's barbed legs tightened their grip.
Ah, get off of me! Get off of me!
The blade sliced clean through the clinging creature, but it didn't die. No blood ran from the wide cut, and even as Rupert watched, the edges of the wound knitted together and were gone.
What the?
The creature slithered along the unicorn's neck toward Rupert, leaving a trail of tiny blood wounds on the unicorn's pale white skin. Mismatched arms and legs sprouted continuously from its hairy body and were as quickly reabsorbed.
Why won't you die?
Rupert ran the demon through from end to end, and it surged forward along the blade to seize his sword arm with half a dozen bony hands. Two sickly yellow eyes peered at him over a wide, slavering mouth filled with hundreds of sliding, grating teeth. Rupert struck at the creature with his numb left arm. The fingers of his left hand sank deep into the demon's flesh just above its eyes, and then slowly started to close. The demon struggled to break free, but Rupert somehow ignored the mounting pain that seared through his arm and shoulder again and concentrated on forcing his hand deeper and deeper into the demon's flesh. His fingers suddenly came alive, screaming agony with every movement, but past the pain he could feel something soft and yielding, pulsing frantically in his hand, the demon's heart. Rupert pulled his arm from the creature, bringing a gelatinous mass along with his numbed hand. The creature shook wildly and then drooped to sag from his arm. It slowly melted from the unicorn's neck, running to the ground in rivulets and sheets. Rupert freed his throbbing sword arm with little effort.
Unicorn! Let's go home.
The ice-covered moat lay straight ahead, and within moments they were on the ancient, sturdy wood of the drawbridge. Rupert shook his aching head to clear it. He hadn't seen the drawbridge being lowered. The champion had already entered the keep and was standing before the closed inner doors.
Open the doors on command of the king's champion! Open them this moment!
Rupert entered the keep as the doors slowly opened. He looked back the way he came and saw the 10 remaining guardsmen were slowly approaching the drawbridge, exhaustion showing in their every movement. What remained of their armor was soaked in blood, but every one of them still carried his sword. The High Warlock floated slowly after them, power surging from him in great shimmering waves that bowed the huge trees around him like a mighty gale. Demons surrounded the party, but did not dare enter the sphere of light.
The doors are open. Come on, sire.
The champion rushed inside to sanctuary, and the unicorn lurched forward. Rupert brandished his sword defiantly at the darkness and rode through the gatehouse into the safety of the castle courtyard.
Close the doors!
What? No! Leave the doors! My men are still out there!
To hell with your men! The demons are out there! Close the door!
The guard broke off suddenly as Rupert set the point of his sword at the man-at-arms' throat. Their eyes met, and the man-at-arms' lower lip almost trembled. He stared up at the torn and bloodied figure leaning over him and knew beyond any doubt that this man was more dangerous than any creature from the Darkwood.
Those doors are staying open till all my men are in! Now give the order, or I swear I'll cut you down where you stand!
Hold the doors! And stand by to repel demons! We got men coming in!
Rupert lowered his sword and turned away to stare out into the darkness, the man-at-arms already forgotten. His men were finally coming home, and tired and battered and bloodied as he was, a grim pride welled up in him as his 10 remaining guardsmen helped each other across the drawbridge and into the courtyard, waving away all offers of help from the castle men-at-arms. Even after all they'd been through, after all the dark wood had thrown at them, they were still determined to finish their journey on their own 2 feet. The High Warlock was the last man remaining. He flew down to land in the keep, glaring out into the darkness. Rupert wasn't sure, but he thought he saw the man swaying a little. The light surrounding him went out, and the land plunged into darkness once again. The high magic he'd unleashed no longer beat upon the air, but some trace of its ancient power still remained, lending his frame a dark and brooding dignity. Demons gathered on the edge of the castle's pool of light, but made no move to approach the warlock. He turned his back on them and stalked into the courtyard. The demons acted as one. They surged forward.
Close the doors! Close the doors!
Rupert just had time to glimpse the drawbridge rising into the air, already overrun with clinging demons. He locked eyes with a single demon, running ahead of the others, its arms outstretched as it reached between the heavy oaken doors.
Blue Moon Rising is a Graphic Audio production. Copyright 1991, Simon R. Green. All rights reserved. Production copyright 2009, The Cutting Corporation. All rights reserved. Performed by Terrence Aselford, David Coyne, Elizabeth Jernigan, Scott McCormick, Richard Rowan, James Konacek, Christopher Graybill, Mort Shelby, Andy Clements, Tim Getman, Peter Stray, Joe Brack, Jonathan Watkins, Dylan Lynch, Michael John Casey, Eric Messner, Ken Jackson, Michael Glenn, and Nanette Savard. Additional red shirts performed by The Dead Giveaways. Directed by Terrence Aselford. Produced by Rick Rowan and Dwayne Beeman. Executive producers James Cutting, Mary Cutting, and Angie Cornett. Adapted for Graphic Audio by Dan Smith. Dialogue editing and Graphic Audio sound design by Nathaniel Perry. The Blue Moon Rising theme was composed by Dan Smith. Additional original music by Dan Smith and Johann Detweiler. If you enjoyed Blue Moon Rising, be sure to look for R.A. Salvatore's Demon Wars Saga, available at road stops everywhere, at 1-800-670-5220, or at www.graphicaudio.net. Keep listening for a preview of another Graphic Audio title.
From the author of the critically acclaimed Elantris comes a beautifully crafted tale of dark intrigue, bitter rivalries, and powerful magic. In order to save his kingdom of Idris from certain annihilation, King Dedalan must honor a treaty made long ago. He must send his oldest daughter to marry Suzabron, the God King of Alondrin.
War is coming, Your Majesty. They will attack.
If we send her, Yarda, we send her to her death.
Sending Vivenna is a poor plan, but it's our only plan.
Father, if we break this treaty, it will mean war. I am prepared to sacrifice for our people.
Lord God of Colors, forgive me. Vivenna, you will not go to wed the tyrant god of our enemies. I'm sending Ciri to your place.
Ciri, the youngest daughter of King Dedalan, soon finds herself plunged into a world of intrigue and politics, inhabited by undead gods and zombie armies. And she quickly learns that there is a darkness spreading through the highest order of Alondrin, threatening to consume all she loves.
Vessel, doing your duty as the vessel was the danger.
You have to tell me something.
You must not bear him a child. That is the danger. This all, everything here in the palace, is not what it appears to be.
Cursed with a lecherous form of magic which causes her to feed off the souls of the living, Princess Vivenna battles to save the life of her sister and prevent the war engine of Alondrin from crushing her homeland.
Your father and Lemix were right. The Alondrin have everything to lose by not attacking you.
I'm not going to become an Awakener, Dim. I might turn a blind eye toward that lifeless for now, but I will not awaken.
Court of the Gods, the highest authority in all of Alondrin, Lightsong the Bold, resurrected hero of ages since past, must come to grips with his newfound immortality as he struggles to unlock the dark secret of the Pantheon of Gods and their unstoppable armies of the undead.
What do they want of me, Larimar? Do they really think I'll do it? Lightsong the Selfish, do they really think I'd give my life for one of them?
You offer hope, Your Grace. A last unlikely hope.
And if they're wrong, I have no desire to die. And why should it be otherwise? I mean, we have to die to heal one of them. We're gods to them only until they kill us.
And the key to halting the baying hounds of war may lie in the hands of the one man who wants to watch the world burn. Vasher, the Warbreaker.
Yeah. Are you here to frame me?
No, Vahir. I'm here to kill you.
Don't miss Brandon Sanderson's high fantasy masterpiece, Warbreaker. Available now in graphic audio.
If you can't find that graphic audio title you're looking for, go to www.graphicaudio.net, where you can order it in CD format or digital download. If you're on the road, call 1-800-670-5220. That's 1-800-670-5220 or www.graphicaudio.net.